8-meter mirrors. I am curious, Paul, are the two mirrors mounted together on the same turntable, or does each mirror of each telescope have a thoroughly separate turntable? Back to you on that one, Paul.
Well, when they showed it, it looks like it's the same, but according to the website, when I went to it, they could operate independently. In fact, one of them came online before the other. The reason it made the news, the other one is now being put into operation. The spacing was 14 meters, I think, between the two there. So, somehow they add up to 22. If you, the equivalent of one big 22 mirror. They call it a honeycomb structure. So I don't know what they mean by that, but that's the mirror design in that fashion. Back to you.
Yeah, most of the time nowadays, the word honeycomb structure means that the mirror is not one single mirror. Mount Palomar, which is 200 inches, which is what? Something like 18 feet, which is something like six meters. To my knowledge, that's the largest single piece of glass that has ever been made. All modern-day telescopes consist of a whole bunch of hexagonal pieces fitted together to make the mirror, and they're all individually tuned to get the accuracy requirement. A much, much simpler technique than one single piece of glass. Corning went through hell building that 200-inch mirror. I think they had to do it twice. I think it took years to cool it off, to not develop any stresses and so on, and probably years to grind it. So one single mirror that size is essentially out of the question. So that's what I think what they mean by the honeycomb mirror. And the main reason I'm asking why are each of the two mirrors on the same turntable is that my understanding of interferometry would make that a much easier correcting procedure as the Earth turns and the sky moves. As the Earth turns and the sky moves, your baseline length, your projected baseline length between the two telescopes is continuously changing. And to create interferometry on the baseline, which means the equivalent electronic distance between the two mirrors is continuously changing, that strikes me as a very difficult problem to solve. So, as you went to the website, do you think the two mirrors of the two separate telescopes move together as one assembly, or is each one mounted on the ground separately, and each one separately, well, separately steerable is not what I'm asking. Do they move together as one unit, do you believe, Paul? Go ahead.
Well, if you look at the pictures, it does look that, like that, Dick. I went through all the different technical stuff that they wrote about it, and I didn't see that they operated independently or together. So there's really no way of knowing. Nice picture of it, anyway. If you go to that website, it's there. Oh, I didn't write the website down. What if you went to Large Binocular Telescope, Mount Graham, Arizona? It's a town called Safford, SAFFORD, Southern Arizona. You can bring up their website. There's quite a few different things. You can go to space.com. When you bring up the Google, all these things come up. But if you go to the actual website, without going to space.com, you'll see all the information. I mean, who funds it, how many different countries are involved, University of Arizona is involved, West Virginia, plenty of groups are it's really an international effort. 20 years in the making.
Sounds like a goodie. I've told quite a few people over the last week that if you get a hold of the April issue 2008 of Smithsonian Magazine, on the front cover, beautiful article on the subject of black hole research, particularly the black hole that's in the center of our galaxy, as they make improvements in their telescopes, they're able to look closer and closer at infrared frequencies through the haze and look at the black hole in the center of our galaxy, which is something like 8 million times more massive than our sun, 10 times bigger in diameter than our sun, and there are a very massive, 10 times our sun mass, very massive stars, whipping around that black hole at 3% of the speed of light. I think it's 20 million miles per second, miles per minute, miles per hour, 20 million miles. Very big number. The article makes it clear that the stranger and stranger stuff is going on in the center of our galaxy. And our galaxy isn't the one with the biggest black hole. The one with the biggest black hole locally is Andromeda. The next galaxy over from us has a black hole that's approximately 1 billion size times the solar mass. That's heavy. Okay. I think we've answered everyone's questions that called in with a question tonight. I'm going to give a little bit of a pause as we pass it over to Mel. And Mel, time for you to dig into your mailbag if we have no other questions at this time. K2KEY with a little bit of delay. K2RIW in the TechNet.
The U.S. Glenn, one comment about the black hole thing.
Yeah, go ahead, Paul. Yeah, go ahead, Paul.
Okay, I wonder if that article says that the so-called supermassive black hole have the, they still use that term? I think anything over, I don't know, over 10 masses of the sun, it becomes a black hole, and then there's a certain number where they, where it becomes a supermassive black hole, but I don't know what that number is.
Okay. The absolute minimum size of a black hole has been calculated to be 3 solar masses. Anything less than 3 solar masses cannot form a black hole. It might be able to find a form a neutron star or a white dwarf, but not a black hole. That particular black hole in the center of our galaxy, as I remember, was 8 million times our sun. I don't remember the article using the word supermassive. And when they did talk about the one that's a billion solar masses in the center of the Andromeda galaxy, I don't think they used the word supermassive there. And some of the unexpected material in the article is that they're using an orange-colored laser, a liquid dye laser running very high power, 18-inch diameter spot in the sky, lights up the sodium atoms that are at the top of our atmosphere. That in turn becomes an artificial star that allows them to align the adaptive optics that allows them to see higher resolution and to take out the distortion of the atmosphere. And those sodium atoms that are at the top of our atmosphere are deposited there by impacts of meteors. So the partial light pollution created by meteor impact creates the sodium atoms at the top of the atmosphere that we in turn light up with a powerful laser right alongside of the telescope, which is more light pollution, in order to get higher resolution to look at the blackest object in the universe. There's some kind of a paradox there. That kinds of light pollution are helping us look at the blackest area. And as I said earlier, you've heard the expression, it's ill wind that blows no good. So those meteors crashing into our atmosphere are doing some real good when it comes to giving us the ability to create the artificial star, the artificial guide star, that allows us to align the adaptive optics that takes out the atmospheric distortion. The atmosphere is continuously boiling, very similar to what it would look like if you threw a quarter into the bottom of your pool on a sunny day and you look at it. The water is always moving at the surface, and the quarter looks somewhat distorted. Well, our atmosphere is continuously doing that. So with some fancy adaptive optics, a bendable lens that they put in between the main mirror and the final camera of a modern-day telescope, that bendable mirror, if you distort it just right, in millisecond periods, you can take out 99% or something like that of the atmospheric distortion.
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
And therefore you get a much higher resolution picture of what you're looking at out there in the universe. You get a brighter, higher resolution picture, finer detail. Good stuff. Over to you, Paul. And did you get any interesting mail this week? And one of these days, according to Andy, WA2CDO, we should discuss the some of the details of what goes into the Bessel modulation functions of FM modulation. You're listening to an FM modulated signal right now. In theory, the FM modulation of the signal with my voice is creating an infinite number of side lobes. With amplitude modulation, like AM or single sideband, you only get one set of side lobes for each individual tone of the voice or the data you're reproducing. But with FM modulation, so-called angular modulation, you produce an infinite number of side lobes. As you go far out, they fall off real fast, but every transmitter and every receiver only has finite bandwidth, and you only transmit some of those side lobes. In the beginning, way back in the 1930 time frame, the mathematicians were predicting that you couldn't transmit the infinite side lobes, therefore FM modulation would never work. Well, Armstrong proved that it worked anyhow. Unfortunately, he didn't get very much of the credit for inventing the procedure and popularizing it. But that's another whole story. So someday we have to discuss how to calculate the amplitude of the side lobes once you know the modulation index, the percentage of modulation that you're doing in an FM manner. Andy did say that when he's got some time someday, we're going to be discussing that. K2KEY, K2LIW on the TechNet.
This is K2KEY. Dick, just one thing before I lose my mind completely. You mentioned that you were using the Hewlett Packard Flow. Is it an 8640? You weren't using the one on, because I remember one. Maybe I'm thinking the wrong generator, but I'm just curious. There was, I thought it was the 8640 that I was using at that time. Was a NABCON signal generator that we were using that time for VOR. Am I on the right track?
You go ahead and start reading the first mail out of the mailbag. I'll take the handy talkie in hand, walk to the other end of the house. I'll be able to hear you as I talk. I'm going to read the model number on the front panel of the one that I'm in the process of repairing, that little slide switch on the lower left-hand side. I'll find out exactly which one it is that I've fallen in love with. Over to you, Mel.
Not that important. I was just curious that was... I remember at that 8640, I just happened to say it. I think it was an 8640, which was used as a testing marker beacon at the time. I was with the working temporary company, and was for VOR and VHF communication, which is the aviation industry. So, anyhow, I just was wondering if I think it's the wrong generator. All right, let's see. What do we got? Okay, and there's a couple people. I think I've had a repeat a couple of times on the same question. This one here says, I have a ground plate for 2 meters that's been up there for a while, and I see now that the radios have begun to droop, the four radios, and they have begin to really have a real droop on them. They were nice, kind of straight almost. When I first put it up, and now they're kind of droopy, and it's a bit bit of a problem. I have to get somebody to go up there, but is it worth repairing, or do you think that it has no effect on the group? Okay, so let me answer that. We'll take that up as number one. All right, Vic is wandering off there with Andy talking. So we'll just have 1 minute before he was curious. I don't know. I'm sorry to send him on a trip for nothing. That's not that important. But, all right, this happened to jump into my mind about, I thought it was a Hewlett Packard 8640 called the NAVCOM 6, but I think that's... Okay, Dick, you back?
Yes, I am. I had to walk all the way to the other end of the house. It is a Hewlett Packard 8640 Bravo, according to the rain switch on the front panel. It does, it's rated to go to 1,024 megahertz. And we found out from Ed tonight that it goes to 1,090. I'll have to test mine and see how far mine goes. He claims not very much further. I guess it doesn't quite make 1,296, but by way of tuning it to half of 1,296 and listening to the second harmonic, or putting it through a crystal detector, you could easily generate the second harmonic. So that's not much of a problem. I think it will put out as much as plus 15 or plus 17 dBm when it's flat out. So it's got more than enough drive to drive a crystal multiplier to give you higher frequencies if that's what you want. I haven't actually listened to it on a good sideband receiver to know what kind of stability it has, but various people have said that that's one of the most steady signal generators the Hewlett Packard has ever made. There are people who think that it's got superior performance to many frequency synthesizers, and it's a hell of a lot cheaper and easier to use. So it is just called the signal generator. I didn't actually read the label, but it is 8640B, and that's the one I've been talking about, and we're awful happy with them. When it comes to a NAV product or something like that, I'm pretty sure that that's not in the label. Back to you, Mel.
Oh, by the way, DTJJ with a comment.
Go ahead, Jeff.
Plus 13 dBm.
I guess you said rated to plus 13. I've seen plus 16 or plus 17 out of mine at roughly 900 megacycles. So I think they got a little bit of extra steam in there. Mr. JJ, go right ahead, Doug.
Yeah, good evening, Dick. They also made a military version of that counter, which was referred to as the AMUSM323. That was a ruggedized version. It's all black and a very, very rugged case. It also came in an outer protective case, which was bright yellow. Same generator, though.
Doug, you called it a counter. And this thing I'm using is a signal generator with a very good built-in frequency counter. You sure you're talking about a SIG gen?
Yeah, I'm sorry, Dick. I meant signal generator. Yeah, same unit, the 8640 Bravo, was referred to with the military ruggedized version was the Alpha November Uniform Sierra Mike 323.
How about that? ANUSM 323 is really HP 8640. Ed, when you said that it only puts out plus 13 dBm, are you talking about its rating or what your particular unit will do, Mr. EAV?
When I was running the tests on Wednesday, I noticed it would not go above plus 13 dBm at 1090. Even though the knob and the meter go up to plus 20, the meter stopped moving at about plus 14, so I backed off to plus 13 and left it there.
Yes. Where it's rated to 1024 and you're using it at 1090 beyond its rated region, that last stage of amplification. My guess is your voltage-controlled oscillator is running out of steam, your amplifier is running out of steam, and so on. That doesn't bother me. And I've also noticed that mine probably is a little bit below spec. As I said, I'm only getting plus 16 or 17, something like that, at around 900 megacycles, which I think is a little bit below what it's supposed to produce. within its rated frequency region, like 900 meg, the dial goes to plus 20, and the center little knob on the main power output step attenuator really adjusts the needle that you see on the major on the Dawson dial movement, and that's literally measuring what power is going in, coming out of the final stage. And as I said, mine runs out at that power level. You probably didn't get a chance to find out what yours would do at a lower frequency. Did you, Red? Go ahead.
Why would I? I only needed it at one frequency, WB2EAV.
Out of curiosity, Ed, if this was the best of all worlds, what kind of power would you like to have gotten out of it?
Plus 13 dBm was just fine.
Sounds good. And I have a vague idea what goes on at 1090. Very good stuff. Okay, when it comes to those radios that are on a ground plane antenna, they're extremely insensitive within reason. By that I mean, if you took every one of the ground plane radios and ripped it off and threw them away, the antenna would still work. Your VISWAR would climb. If your antenna started off as a 1.4, it would probably go to a 1.9, which is still on the air and still working like a charm. And you would definitely have some excess current flowing down the outside of the coax cable. Not going to catch on fire. Not going to do anything bad. If you did a signal strength report with your buddy X number of miles away, with all of the radios connected and all the radios disconnected, I'd have quite a bit of trouble believing he would see much more than one decibel of difference in signal strength. It's nice to have them, but it's not a showstopper if they're not there. That's if you thoroughly remove them. If you just tilt them a little bit, you get much lower impact in the change of performance than I've been describing. It's good to have them on a VHF antenna, but without them, it's not a showstopper. In the case of a ground plane antenna in your backyard on 80 to 10 meters, the situation is a little bit worse. You disconnect those, your VISWAR will climb. That's the part that you can easily measure. The part that you can't measure is that your efficiency of your antenna might go from, say, 70%, putting it down to like 8%. You know, numbers that big a change, because without the ground plane radials and without enough of them, a lot of your RF energy is going into heating up that local soil. And that will not necessarily show up on your standing wave ratio meter. You won't know it, but it's happening. So when the antenna is elevated in the air, then nowhere near as important, in my opinion. K2KEY, K2RIW.
This is K2KEY, okay. No tubing radios, not going to have much of an effect on your antenna, and you don't have to worry about them. Just they're all going to tube eventually, because the elements outside, the wind, Mother Nature, and of course gravity eventually, I guess, will bend that nice looking antenna. It's going to start to look a little on the lousy side, but I don't think it's going to have much of an effect on how well it works, correct?
Yeah, that is what I'm saying, Mel. A rather minor effect. Nice to have them, but it's not a showstopper if they're not there. I wouldn't lose a lot of sleep about it. If you're bringing the antenna down for maintenance for other reasons, then try to restore them to their original condition. I would not bring the mast of my antenna down just to repair that function. Back to you, Mel.
Guess we answered that question. The gentleman did say instead of a problem, have to hire somebody to go up there and get it down. So leave it alone, save your money. All right, next one here. This one here, I've had a lot of these questions. Problems with power supply, noise, and I've seen this now. In fact, I experienced it firsthand that the switching power supply are a problem child. And I'll give you a for instance. If I have on, I have one switching power supply that filters to the computer. If I have that on and I'm using the receiving loop, it creates a number of places that are really outstandingly noisy on the 80, 75 meter band. I mean, really unusual amounts of noise. Think space every about 25 kilohertz, which I would assume means that they're switching power supply must be running at 25 kilohertz. But there's been complaints now, a number of them, asking, what can I do with the power supply that came with the transceiver or the one that they recommend with the transceiver? And you purchase it, and they're hearing at certain spots, certain amateur radio bands from the power supply, which drove them crazy until they were able to finally substantiate that by what I recommended is, you know, the transceiver basically run on 12 volts to borrow or whatever a battery and see if it eliminates the problem. And I got a lot of positive feedback on that. So what do you suggest? Do you have any ideas what to do with switching power supplies that are creating noise over?
Yeah, I'm going to tell you some of the solutions that FUQFOD, Manfred von Hinrich, I keep forgetting his call letters. You guys will remind me on the next time you get a chance to transmit. What makes his power supply so quiet is two or three things. Extremely good inductive capacitive input filtering on the raw voltage that goes into it. Extremely good inductive capacitive filtering on the regulated voltage that comes out of it, and control of the switching transistors. His circuit monitors the amount of current that is being demanded by the switching power supply, and it adjusts the drive level to the switching transistors accordingly. He doesn't overdrive the switching transistors if they're not being called on to produce a lot of output current. The net result is that they don't spend so much time being yanked in and out of saturation. You saturate a transistor and then yank it out of saturation because it's connected to a transformer that's its core saturation of its magnetics. You're getting all kinds of inductive kickback of the transformer, and you're getting all kinds of transient effects within the transistors themselves that is hard to live with as far as higher frequency harmonic generation is concerned. So, as I said, he's adjusting the drive level proportional to output current. He's got everything carefully timed, and he's not yanking those transistors out of hard saturation with a saturated magnetic transformer. That combined with good shielding. So good filtering in, good filtering out, control of the drive, and good shielding. Put it all together, he's got a power supply where the output voltage of the power supply under load, you capacitively couple it to a 80 to 10 meter receiver, sweep across all the handbands, and you don't find anything. That's a power supply. That's what a switching regulator, properly designed, is capable of doing. Let me drop.
What is this thing cost?
It's a home brew. It's the lead article in the December 1999 issue of QST Magazine. It's the first half of the article. The second half of the article is in January 2000. Lead article, QST Magazine. He is 80 miles outside of Santiago, Chile, in the mountains of Chile, working for the European Southern Observatory. Has no access to good equipment that he can buy. He has no local Radio Shack. He homebrewed that transformer. He took available transistors and available parts. So the price of the power supply in kit form would not be high. It's an extremely good design. Not commercially made. That's your first question. This is a very well-designed switching power supply. You probably have some more questions about that, Ed. So I'll turn it back to you, Ed. Go ahead.
The filtering won't do you any good if the box isn't shielded. So now you got a fair amount of sheet metal. Then you got to have your dirty box filter cons on both input and output You're talking significant filtering. You're talking about the circuitry. Do I assume you mean is it just lets the transistors barely go into saturation without driving them? All this stuff takes material and labor. WB2EAB.
To a degree, you're right, Ed. The average guy that looks at that article, December issue 1999, QST Magazine, lead article, the average guy looks at that and said, why the hell does it have twice as many parts as any sort of a switching regulator I've ever seen? And the answer is it's got fold-back protection, it's got drive circuit control, it's got indirect drive saturation, not saturation of the output transistors themselves and the magnetics. He's not saturating the output transformer. He does not use expensive filter cons on the input and the output. He's using relatively easy to homebrew LC filtering. He has no exotic parts. The most exotic part is a commonly available core that he winds the transformer on, which wasn't big enough, so he stacked three of them together and epoxied the whole assembly. So with real craftiness, he took inexpensive available parts and made a very sophisticated power supply. You're absolutely right. And by the way, the metal shielding of the cabinet is not done to 120 decibel EMI specs. It is moderately good shielding, nothing fancy. He's controlling the harmonics. He is stopping most of the glitches at the source. He's not trying to get rid of them after they're made. He is essentially stopping their manufacture in the first place. Back to you, Ed.
It sounds like a perfectly simple design. It's just when some guy looking in a catalog to buy a switching power supply commercially available, he saw the price of this compared to the commercially available competition. You know, his eyes were going around in opposite circles.
Absolutely not. This is not a commercially available power supply. And if you and I wanted to make a commercial product out of it, you and I would starve. You could not manufacture this thing and make a profit with the competition that presently exists. You've got a zillion switching power supplies out there with yucky performance as far as glitches are concerned, higher harmonics, and electromagnetic interference is concerned. But that is not what the average guy is buying when he buys a power supply. He looks at how many amperes does it deliver, how many pounds does it weigh, and how many dollars does it cost, approximately in that order. Way down at the list, if the guy is smart enough, to ask, oh, what's the EMI rating? How many, what's the millivolts or volts of spikes it generates? The average purchaser of power supplies does not ask that question. There are so few people who do ask that question that you and I would not survive if we opened up that business. That's why it's an article as a homebrew project in QST Magazine. And I'm not convinced that anyone near very soon is going to make it into a commercial product. That article came out December of 1999, that was eight or 9 years ago, and I don't think anyone's made a commercial product out of it yet. I think I know why. Back to you, Ed, for any other comments while you're walking the dog.
Dog, I'm walking blood chemistry. I understand perfectly. And yes, there are houses that do military switching power supplies that have to meet mil standard 462 EMI, which I'm sure would be just about what we're talking about. Of course, they also meet all kinds of other environmental specs, like all kinds of whoopee-doo stuff like salt fog that we don't need. And they're available for a couple of thou.
Understand. So, it's nice to know that if you need an exotic, lightweight, high performance, high efficiency, high reliability, these power supplies have been used throughout all those mountaintop repeaters in Chile. And he's the guy that's got to climb the mountain and fix it when they fail. And he's the guy that's a real persnickety guy about the minor details of what created the failure and how he can correct it on the next one. You're looking at a second or third generation product when you look at that particular schematic diagram. It's an extremely long article with a lot of details of why he did each thing he did. You write him an email, and he'll give you 5,000 more words than he did to me as to all the other information that was too voluminous for QST to print in the magazine. That gives you other useful information about hints and kinks as to how to build it, where to get the parts, why he did it, and why it's so good, and where the reliability came from. And what were his trials and tribulations in the function of designing that. Lots of good information. You could make a graduate level course out of power supply engineering by taking Manfred's 5,000 or 10,000 words on the subject plus the schematic diagram of that power supply, dissecting it, reverse engineering it, studying it, and teaching students how to do it. If you and I were running a bachelor level senior course, you know, freshman, sophomore, junior, senior, at the senior level, we're teaching electronic engineers how to do a good power supply design. You and I could make a great course out of that single product. Over to you, Ed, for any other comments.
On the other hand, while I admire what he did, it's quite impressive from your description. You know, not everybody has to go that crazy. I have been switching power supplies for low stuff that I've used in close proximities to receivers without any problems, without going completely nuts. So maybe there is a middle ground.
Without a doubt, there's always a middle ground. But like the New York Times, you don't have to read it all. It's nice to know it's all there. You can pick and choose how many of his techniques you want to use in your next switching power supply design. You don't have to use them all. Choose how many dB of rejection of the undesired product you desire. And use that number of his concepts. In my mind, it's all there. And without going crazy, I don't think he went crazy. He's got twice as many parts. From his point of view, he wasted an extra $50. It is my belief he got his money's worth by a long shot in both reliability and quietness. If I was hiring somebody to do it, I would ask for almost every one of those features. Oh, by the way, it's also got some light emitting diodes to tell you what status it's in as it's operating. K2KEY, K2RIW on the tech net.
KC2QIQ with a comment.
Go ahead, Glenn.
Well, being a power supply engineer for about the better part of 20 years now, one of the interesting things that just on the issue of noise, you can design filters, I mean, put huge ones on the input and the output side, and when you've done it, it could wind up doing absolutely nothing. And the reason there is because one of the biggest problems with switching power supplies is layout, and more layout. The more attention that's given to the layout and how the power flow runs across the board, how the connectors are terminated. Sometimes, the thing that really drives me nuts is when I'll have a design where a system's already been designed, and the power supply has to wind up in the corner, and someone puts the input and the output connectors all on the same pins, pretty much, with just, you know, a few hundred thousand spacing, and says, yeah, can you keep the noise off this? All what I'm saying to KC2QIQ.
Yeah, you're absolutely right, Glenn. I've worked on an extremely sensitive receiver, transceiver, where some foolish person put the minus 130 dBm receiver line an eighth of an inch away from the 10-watt power output transmitter line on a coplanar waveguide printed circuit board. So in this coplanar waveguide, on this motherboard, the receiver line was adjacent to the transmitter line, and from the sensitivity of minus 130 to the plus 10 watts, which is plus 40, you needed 170 decibels of isolation between two things that were an eighth of an inch apart. Extremely poor layout. The layout is very critical. I mean, the mechanical engineers and the circuit layout people, the printed circuit people, may have had good reason for efficiency, so to speak, of layout, cubic inches used, and crossover, number of wires that cross over each other and whatever. They may have had good reason to put it that way. They obviously had absolutely no wireless RF engineering smarts when they did it that way. They created a huge amount of grease that had to be redesigned downrange. On top of that, when it comes to a switching power supply, in my mind, the worst thing you can do is to have an extremely heavily saturated transistor that's overdriven, where it's going to stay saturated for the next 5 microseconds, no matter what the hell you do. It's being fired into a very low resistance, saturable core inductor, which goes into saturation, and the voltage drop across the winding jumps to zero while the transistor is in full flat-out conduction. The instantaneous current you get during that period of time, the instantaneous dissipation within that transistor, if you really calculate it, would scare the hell out of you. That spike of magnetic current, that spike of real current, that electromagnetic field that it emits during that next couple of microseconds is really equivalent to what happens when you take a pair of 1,000 microfarad capacitors, one of them's charged up to 10 volts and one of them's at 0 volts, and you simply connect them together with a great big fat screwdriver. You have an irresistible force and an immovable object. And one of the, one of the interesting calculations to do in the senior year of electrical engineering is to calculate what is the stored energy in your capacitors before you started the experiment. You short them out with a zero contact device, and you calculate what amount of energy is left in the capacitors after the experiment, and you had no resistance anywhere, you had an ideal capacitor, and you ask the student, where the hell did all the energy go? And the answer is, you created a spike of current so fierce that half all the energy you started with got radiated into space, literally. That's what happens when you put a pair of capacitors across each other, where one is charged and one is not, and you have no damping resistor or any other kind of a damping network. You just simply connect them together. You're essentially doing that if you are foolish enough to make a switching power supply where the transistors get yanked out of saturation by the transformer that's connected to their collector or to their drain. Very foolish design. You make an electromagnetic pulse that you're going to use heroics to get rid of. Manfred recognized that problem at the source and stopped it at the source. From my point of view, it's the right way to do it. Who cares if it took him an extra 20 components to do it? They were not expensive components. We all resist doing that because we say to ourselves, hey, I've never done it that way. Well, there are smarter people than me that will say, if you keep doing it the way you've always done it, you'll keep getting what you always got. And maybe it's time for a change. Maybe he's a little bit ahead of his time. Maybe it's time we shift our thinking of what good power supply switching design looks like. That's a strongly felt set of opinions. Over to you, Mel. Look what a bag of worms you opened up. K2KEY, K2LAW.
K2QIQ with one more comment.
Go ahead, Glenn.
Yeah, well, actually, you know, there have been some very, very significant improvements in switching power supplies in the last 20 years. One being, originally, most of the power supplies were bipolar switches initially. And, like you said, coming in at a saturation storage time, the energy across the transistors and the transformer, it was a disaster. You needed tremendous snubbing, and the noise was horrible. Then MOSFETs came into shape, and you had about half that charge, and a huge performance improvement there, reduced it that much more. Today in more modern designs now, none of those are really issues anymore, mainly because the technique of soft switching. Basically, you're opening and closing the switches during either a condition of zero voltage or zero current. So closures are taking place at that low energy point. That's probably the most common use lines where basically the frequency varies a little bit and the pulse width, so they kind of move together. And it's usually adjusted with a current monitor on the switch and a reset clamp. So that's a more modern technique. And in most modern power supplies today, the noise is generally coming from the rectifiers. But there again, we're moving to active rectifiers now, just replacing rectifiers with MOSFETs that are more of them. So there's a tremendous amount of change in the science that KP2 is right there.
Yeah, those MOSFETs that are used for the rectification, I call that synchronous rectification. Beautiful design. And you got the right idea. So some people are recognizing what the problem is and applying solutions. And I guess they've got to do it kind of slowly, because if you did it all at once, your supply would be kind of expensive and no one would buy it. Because the world hasn't caught on yet as to what kind of performance well-designed switching power supplies are capable of doing. K2KEY,
KQLIW. Okay, this is K2KEY. Well, X22FOD power supply is not a very complicated thing. The whole complication is making the coils, you know, winding these things, because it is not available anything that is, you know, commercial. Nobody has picked up on this power supply. But if you look at it, it's very simple. In fact, he's got so much circuitry involved just to run the fan. That's the funny part, the fan controls. You've got a whole bunch of stuff in there that have actually eliminated that. I didn't need that because I got the fan on all the time. But he had a whole fancy circuit there with a fan trigger circuit to sense temperature and everything. But other than that, it's pretty straightforward. And his whole secret is, I could say, he does a lot of filtering. A nice filter on the input circuit, on the AC line, and on the outside, a whole series of lots of beads and everything. Really, you know, very well designed and everything like that. And I built a version of it. Not exactly the way he has it. I did a little different. But I'll tell you, in the shack, I still have, I have a number of power supplies. And in the shack, I happen to have one that I like. And it's an oldie. It's with the old conventional power transformer. And I'll tell you how this came about. Many years ago, I was in Houston, they had a ham fest there. One of the guys, that's a friend of mine, that took me there. He's permanent resident there because he worked at that time for Mission Control. So he says, oh, he says, they got a ham fest. He says, we'll go to, I stayed there with them for a while. And, rather than I saved some money, but actually the company would have paid for my hotel, but, you know, being a ham, why not, nothing for nothing. And we went to this ham fest. It was a Labrador fan. Boy, I'll tell you, everything is big as that. And there was a guy that was selling a power supply. I remember him. He was a Chinese guy, called himself C.C. Low, and he called himself Voltronic. And he had a power supply sitting there, and he had it show that the meters were reading 12.5 volts or something, and the load was 35 amps. And he showed that he had a scope on it, the whole business, and he had a clock running with key. In other words, 35 amps, and at that time, like, the clock was showing over 1 hour. And he says, if it's sitting in your ham shack, what do you care if it weighs a few more pounds because it has a power transformer? And he went, and he was in the business for a while, and he was offering them a tip. You could buy it by the pot, you could buy a full kit, or whatever you wanted. But, you know, he brought out a good point. Let it drop again. If it's sitting on a shelf in your ham shack, what's the difference of weight a little bit more? If you got it toted around, I could see it once, like Manfred's here, which only weighs 6 pounds, the complete power supply. And I was able to build it into a cabinet, let's see, that's 8 inches by about 10 inches. That's the cabinet wound up in. And I noticed that all the lamp supplies that I had, none of them are using switching power supplies. They all have like lambda and all their power supplies seem to be with power transformers, unless they've changed over any of these companies in recent years. But the lamp supplies all use conventional power transformers. Go ahead.
Yeah, conventional power transformers and analog linear pass transistor type voltage regulators. The good news is they're nice and reliable and reasonably quiet. The bad news is they sometimes run 70% efficiency. I think Manfrin supply runs closer to 92% efficiency, so doesn't it, Mel? Go ahead.
That's an efficient power supply. I won't deny it. Like I say, it's elegant. It runs at 25 kilohertz, and it's not that efficient as you think it would be, Dick. I don't really want to say, but I measured the efficiency. It's, I think it was maybe a little better than, you know, the others. I think that the, I think that a lot of the off-the-shelf switching power supplies may be only 50% efficient, so I believe he's doing a lot better than that over.
I'm a little bit surprised by that, but his major motivation was reliability and size. And I know that his other problem was that the raw power he has to work with is not very reliable. It goes up and down in frequency and up and down in voltage and so on. So he had to take some pretty yucky raw input power and still deliver a reasonable amount of well-regulated output, 12 and a half or 13 volts, whatever it is. I think it's that it's a 40 ampere rated supply. Is it not? Go ahead.
Under 13.8 volts, 40 amps. Now, if you make the modification, there was a modification that he did come up with was circulated around, if you're interested. And I believe he claimed that after the modification, he was getting 88% efficiency. Six.
Okay, I'll accept that. But that wasn't his highest motivation at the time. He wasn't being forced to run on solar cells on most of his installations. Go ahead.
No, not at all. So he went over a section to section. That's what he emphasized, that the RF noise generated must be cleaned up by each section and the liberal use of ferrite beads. He is losing them in there. Oh, my, I'm telling you, I think, if I remember correctly, I wound up with about a dozen and a half ferrite beads in that power supply deck. However, what I use, you know, there was a company that was being operated by Raytheon. They bought out a power supply company. Now, what was the company? Sorensen. I wonder if you ever heard of them, Dick.
I've definitely heard of them, but I don't know much about them. I think they made transformers.
Sorensen, yes, was making transformers, but they also went in the power supply business. And they were producing for some use a module, a switching module that was made to drive different power supply systems. And in other words, you take this module and you can use it with that feedback on it and all kinds of sensors to shut down. You can set the gate, the sensitivity to shut down, over voltage protection, under voltage protection, all kinds of things. And this module is very heavy. It's a highly shielded module. Must have been made maybe for military use somewhere. And if you take this module, you can shove it right into his circuit and then use his output circuit all. And this module will drive it. That's basically what I use instead of system here. In other words, I use everything more or less similar to what he did, but I use this module in place of his oscillator circuit. And all. This module is extremely quiet. I could say that it's heavy. It's all heck. It must be. I can't imagine what's in there. It must be. It's all encapsulated. You can't open it, of course. But the weight of it feels like it's made out of lead casing over.
Interesting. What did Sorensen sell that for? And are they still in business?
Oh, Raytheon bought them up. I happened to get it from somebody. Gave me a couple of those modules. happen to have a couple of them. And they have one that has a minus output, if you want. There's another one, a positive output. They got one with 28 volts. They had a whole number of them. Where they were supplying them to, I have no idea. But I have a feeling that that was one of the motivations to make this thing, because this thing, you know, I couldn't believe it was a switching unit, because I couldn't detect any kind of glitches out of it at all.
If it's that heavy, it's probably a 60-cycle magnetics in it, and it isn't a switcher.
Got called away from the rig for a minute. You really think it's not a switcher, Ed?
The magic word is heavy. There's nothing heavy in a switcher. Heavy is iron transformer laminations.
KP2QIQ.
Go ahead, Glenn.
Yeah, I'm kind of familiar with Sorensen. They have a very old-time switching power supply company. They made a tremendous amount of lab supplies. Most of their original topologies were based around magnetic resonance. I don't know if you're familiar with that at all, but they used a lot of 60-cycle magnetic resonance transformers. Kind of unique designs, but the majority of them really weren't switchers. They did make a few line switching stuff, but it was, you know, I don't know, kind of crude. In fact, you said KP2 QIQ.
Maybe that explains it. Okay, Mel, your choice if you want to go on to the next one.
I'll describe this module. It's about 4 inches square and about 3/4 of an inch thick, all completely encapsulated, just with pins protruding through the encapsulation. Now, I can't imagine that's a transformer in there that's only 3/4 of an inch thick, but it's amazing that, like I say, you put in, you put the power directly into this thing, and it's got a tap that's 110 and 240, and what else did it have on it? Yeah, a tap 110, 240, and then it had this, the output, and a sense pin that basically you just put the final voltage, that 12 volts, back into it, I guess, and it holds it at that, but the case feels unusual, you know, that's what I'm saying. It feels like a hard, not a type of epoxy or something. It's a kind of a metallic case with rounded off edges and all. I've never seen anything quite like it there, Dover.
KP2QIQ with one more comment.
Yeah, I'm going to ask you, Glenn, would you call that magnetic resonance thing a kind of a power conditioner? I've seen these so-called constant voltage transformers that work by magnetic resonance. And so, by various techniques, the input voltage can go from like 90 to 130, and the output voltage, RMS-wise, stays pretty steady. Back to you, Glenn.
Yes, exactly. That's almost exactly how magnetic resonance is working. And it's really an extensive transformer design with some outboard components, power components on it. But it's a bit on the heavy side, but it does power condition very, very well. And if you're making a pre-regulation stage and also want to do a relatively low-cost power factor correction, that's an interesting way of doing it, an old-fashioned way of doing it anyway, but it does work. Just another quick comment about the modules. There's a company called Vicor in Massachusetts that makes fully isolated modules with wide-range DC input, everything, only about 1/4 of an inch high, and switching frequency on it's about 1 meg. And they're a little noisy conduction plate, but careful with how you lay out the modules and put it in a nice box. You can make a really tiny power supply with a fairly decent amount of power. Back to you, that KP2 QIQ.
ITT, recognized. Get you in a second. Glenn, to run at a 1 meg rate, are they most likely MOSFET transistors doing the switching?
Yeah, they're MOSFET transistors. But remember, they're not being part switched either. I mean, they're being, the gate drives are strong. I mean, they're hitting them in full saturation. But what's happening is they're soft switching, meaning that the transition cycles are opening and closing the switches at either zero voltage or zero current areas, so that basically the transformer is dry when you're opening and closing the switches.
And then not for an amateur's budget.
Okay, the new station, I think it was ITT. Give us your full call and name and proceed.
George, W2566, just some comments on the 60 hertz resonant transformers. They're called saturable cores. They work by clipping the wave. When you look at the output, you're not looking at the sine wave. It's basically a square wave, pseudo square wave with some routing. They tend to run pretty hot. It's too tight. The most common use is for cable TV, where they put 60 volts AC square wave between the center conductor of the cable TV trunk cable and the shield, RF isolated with a broadband choke. They use those power amplifiers to put down on the cable TV.
George, I've got to let you know that your signal is quite low in audio, and it has power supply noise on it that's quite severe. Too bad I didn't make a tape recording of it to play it back to you, so there is some repair required there. Very low audio, a lot of noise in the background, not too easy a signal to copy, even though your RF input to the machine was moderately good. And I think you're in the Suffolk County area because you're very strong on my input. Now back to you, George.
Thanks, okay. I have a problem with the voltage shield.